Oh, sorry. This is a reel four of Dennis Flanders. Please continue.
That a permit was being sent to me by the Lord Chamberlain, who was the officer responsible. Well, this duly came, and I was very excited, of course, and I went along and got into the House of Parliament. It was very difficult to get in these official buildings in those days, lots of policemen about, and they scrutinized one's papers and so on. However, I got in, and I called on the clerk of works there and the people who were in charge of the building, and they said, "Oh, it's a marvelous sight, come along." So they took me up onto the roof, and it's a most wonderful place, the Houses of Parliament. I mean, it's full of pinnacles and turrets and roofs going in all directions, and you look down and into various courtyards which are not apparent from outside. And it's like a great cathedral, or it's like several cathedrals all rolled into one. And then we came along the roof to this scene of destruction, looking down into the what was the Commons Chamber. And it was really frightful to contemplate, except one was getting used to this sort of thing. And I thought, well, this is absolutely marvellous. So I chose a point where Big Ben rose up behind the Commons Chamber was below, we were looking down into it, and there was a wall along the left to the side of the Commons Chamber, and to the left of that you look right down into a courtyard, and then up on the right, to balance the whole composition, was a great gargoyle sticking out, like those you read of in Notre Dame and Strasbourg. And so I set to and made the drawing. Well, now, in the letter Lord Simon had sent to me, I can recall it very well because it made me realize what lawyers are like and how very canny they are in the letters they write, or how very careful they are as to what they put down on paper. In his letter to me, saying that he understood permission was being sent, he added, "When you have finished the drawing, if you feel so disposed to show it to me, I might like to consider purchasing it," which I thought was a very devious way of saying, "I'd like to have first refusal of your picture." However, that's what he said, and I remember it. It's very kind of him, of course, but I thought it was rather a careful way of not committing himself, you know, to buy the picture. Well, having got this picture, which I thought was rather a scoop, I dashed along to the Ministry of Information and had it passed for publication in the manner that we've spoken of before. And then I rushed along Fleet Street trying to get it in a paper, and I took it to the Illustrated London News and they published it. So that was that. I then thought it would be rather nice to make some more money on it, if possible. So I thought I would publish it. Someone told me of some engravers who would make a photogravure engraving of it. Incidentally, it was a wash drawing. It was black and white, but it had a lot of wash tone on it. I then thought I'd like to sell it to MPs. So, again, I made inquiries and found that I had to get the permission of the Sergeant at Arms, I think it was, to bother MPs with a communication. However, I got that. And then I bought Vatcher's Parliamentary Guide, which lists all the MPs and all the peers and all the ambassadors and so on, people like that. Meanwhile, the picture was being printed, and I then had a letter typed, copied, saying this drawing was going to be published at such and such a price. I think a guinea a time I charged, and I had an order form on the bottom, and I sent it out to all the MPs, not all the peers, because I didn't think they'd be interested, but a few, And then also, I sent to the ambassadors. These I recall now are not in Vetch's parliamentary guide. So I looked through all the telephone books, which took a long time, and I found there were an enormous number of embassies. By far the majority seemed to be all these Central and South American republics. His Excellency this, that and the other, Dom Pedro so and so and so and so, was enormously long titles. However, I sent all these invitations out and it turned myself into a sort of businessman, you see. It was all very interesting. And then before I had paid for the... Because all this was being done on a shoestring, you see. It was very difficult to earn very much money in those days. In fact, it's always difficult for an artist to earn money, but it was all pretty slim then. Before I'd had to pay for this engraving, the Guinea checks started coming in with these order forms from these MPs. And it was really quite a success. I think I got about 60, which was a lot, really, for those days. Mm. I mean, £60 was absolutely marvellous. Guineas, rather. They didn't get much response from the embassies. They were far too proud, I imagined. And I don't know about the peers, but however, it didn't concern the House of Lords. And then eventually, the prints were ready, I paid for them, and I had them, and I bought cardboard rolls to put them in so they could be sent through the post, and I sent all the country ones out. They went to Westmorland and Montgomery and Cornwall and Scotland. Now, the London ones, I think there were, I had about 10 with London addresses, and I thought it would be very amusing and interesting to deliver them myself to see where they live, these people, you see, which I did. And there was nothing exciting about that. One was in the Camden Road, one or two were in Westminster. Of course, there are a number around Westminster. MPs always lived around Westminster, and a few in Kensington. But the two I remember very well, and this in a way makes quite a little story. Only two embassies replied and ordered engravings. One was the Soviet ambassador, Mr. Maisky, and the other was the Nepalese legation. I know that's not an embassy, it's a legation, but nonetheless one bracket. And I found to my surprise they were next door to each other in Kensington Palace Gardens. Millionaires Row, and I had a sort of vision that they spoke about it to each other over the garden wall. You say, let's have one. It's absurd, isn't it? Well, I took them along, you see, and I marched up Kensington Palace Gardens, where you have to pass a flunky at the gates there. It's semi-private, you know. And I came to the Russian embassy, big house set in big grounds with laurel bushes and drive up, one gate here, drive up, one gate there, drive out. So I marched up there and all was silent and rang the bell with the roll of the roll in my hand. And a teeny weeny little bit in the door opened and a couple of Mongol eyes looked out, see, like that. And the door opened about 3 inches and a hand came out and I handed the roll. I said, this is for the ambassador. No sound at all. It was taken. The door was shut and that was that. So I turned around and marched out again. Now, the Nepalese legation, as I said, was next door. So I only had a few yards to go and up the drive again. You see a similar house, though different, in its own grounds with laurels and so on. I got halfway up the drive when the great front door swung wide open, right back, and there was a huge English butler standing there smiling, sort of a welcoming smile. And I said, how different! I've just been next door. Door opened only an inch, and he laughed. And he said, what can I do for you, sir? And I said, well, I have a print here for His Excellency. He said, I will give it to him, sir. Thank you very much. and shut the door after I had turned around and gone down there. Wasn't that extraordinary?
It was.
Absolutely true.
Superb.
So I had a very amusing time, and that was the end of that. Oh, well, then, to finish it off, the Lord Chancellor duly saw the picture and did buy it. And I think he gave it to the press gallery in the House of Parliament, where I presume it now hangs. In fact, I'm sure it does, or did a few years ago, because I went there and saw it. So that was a very interesting experience.
Yes.
And then, of course, it took years and years and years for them to build the chamber up again. I think it was about 1948 or 49.
Yes.
So that was that.
Good. Well, let's progress now to where you went into service.
Mm-hmm.
And could you then fill in that in detail, in as far as your rank is concerned, and what you, who you lived among, where you lived, so on. The life there in the service.
Yes. Well, it's not very heroic at all. I was called up. I knew more or less when I was going to be called up, so I was ready for it. It was very difficult beforehand, really, because you will remember that my father was a musician and we had very little money to live on then. And I had a number of commissions, and this was one of the reasons why I didn't join up, why I kept on doing the commissions. And you see, I was helping to keep the family going, as it were. Mm. But then the time came, and I joined up, and I had to go to Cardiff. Now, I seem to remember we spoke about Cardiff, didn't we, before?
We did. And I particularly mentioned the opportunities to draw.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes.
I'm really thinking now of the interior life, the interior army life.
Oh, yes, yes.
Where did you... What was your rank, in fact?
Oh, I was only a sapper, because I was in the Royal Engineers. Mm. Well, a private, first of all. You see, the first 6 weeks, one did... It was called basic training. Everybody did that when they were called up. And there were various camps, basic training camps all over the country. And one lived there for 6 weeks as a soldier, just learning how to be a soldier, as it were. You know, square bashing and learning about rifles and guns and things.
Mm.
And all that, which is more or less changeless, I suppose. It was very tiresome and it was very boring, but...
Unsuited to you?
Oh, no, I wouldn't say that, no. No, I'm not... I don't think this is so. I think the idea that the artist, the young artist, the young musician, the young poet, aesthetic person is very precious. I think this can be rather overdone. And whilst I didn't relish it at all, in fact, I didn't like it, I suppose, looking back, a lot of it comes naturally to a man, you know.
Mm.
Army life is not unnatural. The fact of learning to defend yourself and therefore your family and your country, it may be primeval, but it's true. And there's nothing unnatural. There are, of course, awful things happen. There's a lot of some people one finds are terribly crude and one is rather astonished at the way they behave, but one must be careful about that, of course. But on the whole, when you find yourself thrown together in a certain situation, you do very rapidly become friendly because you have the same things to do and you therefore make the same history and you're living the same life, so that it's really pointless to compare one background with another background, because that's in the part, you know, that's away behind somewhere, behind a door somewhere. So you are then living the same life. Therefore, you take pleasure, or the other, or the opposite. You make friends or you make enemies, a bit of both, I suppose. But you're doing everything together, And this does create a new life, and it's interesting. There are many discomforts, of course. It's cold at night, and the cold water to wash in, and all that sort of thing. I suppose one forgets these things. But I think it was perfectly bearable. Mm. Perfectly bearable. And so there it was. And after the 6 weeks, you had a bit of leave, which was very exciting, of course. I think 10 days, wasn't it? Yes. And then you went back again, and you then found that you'd been posted, as the saying was, to some particular regiment. Some would go to the engineers, some would go to the ordnance corps, some would go to medical corps, and so on, different corps. And I seem to remember that my posting hadn't come through, and I stayed a bit longer. And then, of course, one was a sort of slightly superior to the new intake, and probably assisted the... Incidentally, the people who taught one there were members of what's called a holding regiment, which is probably was probably a part of the regular army. And they were old soldiers, of course. I don't mean old in age, but senior. And you get the usual terrible sergeant major, and you get the slightly better one, and they were all very good fellows. And it was a new experience. I can't really say much more.
Did anyone sit for you? Did you ever do any portraits?
Oh, yes. Oh, this happened pretty quickly. Yes, I think artists are rather fortunate in this respect. And, of course, they also get used... By the military for perhaps made diagrams, you know. I remember having to, there was a gun, the Bren gun we had to learn about, and of course I instantly was asked to do drawings of it and the way you put it together and bits and pieces and so on. This, of course, was very helpful because one often got out of a certain duties, you know, a certain amount of PT, perhaps you were excused in order to do a chart to teach the other chaps. This happened all along the line. Mm-hmm. Well, I thought I was better, really, at staying a private, really. I didn't seek a commission. So then I got posted to...
Do you remember any sitters in particular?
People like to have their portrait. Well, I wasn't very good at portrait painting. I wasn't very fond of it, and I don't think I said, look, I'll draw your portrait ever. Mm. Although I did draw a number of people, but it wasn't there. I don't think I drew anybody there at Cardiff. But later on I did.
Where?
In Ripon, which we've spoken about, at the School of Military Engineering.
This would be more in the way of favours and
relations. Yes, that's right. Yes, and friends. Yes. Mm. Mm. That was nearly...
No one memorable.
No. No, I think not. No, nothing like that. Nothing very heroic. And then after that, I think someone must have considered the drawing abilities, because although I got posted to the Ordnance Corps and spent a very uncomfortable and cold few weeks somewhere in Leicestershire, I think it was, or Warwickshire, or on the borders there, I then got changed to the Royal Engineers, and I think someone had been doing this, although I never heard, I'm not quite certain. And in the engineers, as we've said before, there was quite a lot of work to be done that one could do with one's own knowledge, you know, drawing and so on. So I did spend most of the time, you see, in the engineers at Ripon. It was only afterwards, when I went to Welbeck Abbey, which was when the war was over, that I was advanced to the very high rank of staff sergeant. Mm-hmm. But that was really technical rather than regimental, you see. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's how it goes.
And you mentioned all, you've already talked about your opportunities to go out and draw.
Yes, yes.
Which you used.
Yes, yes.
So that more or less takes care of it, doesn't it?
Yes, but you were, I think, thinking about how I occupied myself in the army at that time, in the Drip. Well, this, one thing, I was in charge of the maps. This I enjoyed very much indeed. All sorts of people came to Ripon on courses, every kind of officer, not only in the army, but I think the RAF as well sometimes came. And so lots of the people came to the map store where I was and asked for various maps. And this was rather interesting. Quite a number of people I knew in City Street turned up, you know, sort of walked into the room with a uniform on and sort of, hello, hello, what are you doing here? This kind of thing. It was very odd. Mm. And very interesting. But the work was, there was a certain amount of regimental work, of course, parading and so on, as there always is in the services, because everybody is a combatant, a possible combatant at any time. But there were diagrams, there were models to be made, which were used by people who came on the various courses, bomb disposal and bridge building, and all the other things that the engineers do. Mm-hmm. So it was quite interesting, really. And then, of course, being there for a considerable time and finding a lot of like-minded people, life was really rather pleasant. Except, of course, there was always the... I mustn't forget, there was always the knowledge that one was under military law. And you had... This was a kind of cloud, mm. which one forgets in retrospect. But you know, you knew you had to be in at midnight, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that, and if you did, you were for it, as it were. So, life was... it certainly wasn't a bed of roses.
Did you write anything at all? Did you write poetry or any articles?
No.
Did you write at all?
No. No.
Have you maintained any links with the army at all, in any sense? In any way? No associations of any sort?
No associations, but having been in the army, I suppose my thoughts frequently turn towards it and make me well disposed to it. Mm. So that when I was commissioned latterly to make drawings for prints of the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst, I naturally relished it, and I didn't find visits there surprising because I already knew something about the army. So, and also, I've had commissions from the Royal Artillery for drawings of the memorial at Hyde Park Corner, you know, with a parade going on mm-hmm. round it. And also the HAC in the city, drawings of their premises there. So I suppose there is a sort of connection.
Yes.
Curiously enough, I've never been asked to do anything for the Navy at Dartmouth or Greenwich, but then, I mean, who knows? It has been a sort of slight army connection.
Before
and one friends, of course, one made friends, one still keeps up with them. Mm-hmm.
But no actual sort of meetings of any kind?
No, nothing like that. No.
One last question about the war art, and that is, in comparison to photographs, mm-hmm. could you perhaps say, have a word to say about what your art might provide that isn't available in photographs? It's not easy to do that, but...
Well, I think it is, in a way. Mm-hmm. It's rather like the stage and the cinema. When the cinema came along, people said, I can recall, Well, I'm not as old as all that. I mean, the Synod was always going on. But people used to say, oh, the stage, you know, the stage won't last very long now. But this hasn't, in fact, happened. Mm. And the reason, I think, is that the stage is more human. Now, this is not quite the same in the arts that we're talking about. But I think the difference between the thousands and thousands and thousands of photographs of the war which show action, something actually happening, which a photograph does do, and a drawing or a painting or a sketch, is that the painting, drawing or sketch is thought out rather more carefully and therefore made more static. To take one of these drawings of mine, because after all this is what we're talking about, it's obviously easier for me to talk about my own drawings than somebody else's. It may show a damaged church or a street with a lot of bomb damage and things lying about all over the place. Well, now, you can take a photograph of that, and that shows it as it was exactly at that morning. Now, a picture, a painting, a drawing, is made more timeless by being composed slightly more carefully. Now, that's the thing. It's composed into a picture. That means balance, you see. That's got nothing to do with war. Mm. It's got to do with the picture itself. It has life of its own. Now, a photograph doesn't really have a life of its own. It represents some sort of life, of course, but it hasn't got a life of its own. Mm. And a drawing has. I would say then, to sum it up, that the painting has more thought to it and will carry a longer lasting message, can be born to be looked at time and time and time again. Mm. And a camera is really a snapshot, that's the word, it's a snapshot, action. Which is over. You know, you look at it once, and you can look at it again if you like, but you don't get any more out of it. Mm. I think that's it. It's difficult, as you say, and I dare say you could write books on these things, and probably people much wiser than I have, but that's what I feel. Because that is, actually, you've touched on a criticism that all artists like me, who, shall we say, are representational or traditional, have had levelled at us lately. They will compare us with photographs. Well, my sort of almost protesting answer is that the picture is a thought-out one and will last on its own merits. That's the thing, I think.